from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In our last hour of Forum, we talked about the daunting task of fixing America's healthcare system. Yet in this country, there's still a doctor for every 350 people. In a country like Haiti, by contrast, there's a doctor for every 10,000 individuals. And in our last program, too, we talked about how the economy still faces real challenges, like unemployment hovering close to 10%. In Haiti, the unemployment is 70%. Haiti's problems are as daunting as any nation on earth. And yet in Haiti, you can also find stories of inspiration and hope. One is captured in a new book called On That Day, Everybody Ate. Its author is Margaret Trost, and she'll join us next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. We can all probably point to a story, a book, a movie that's moved us in some way, that's inspired us, that made you want to act. I came across one of those stories 6 weeks ago when I picked up a small volume about life in Haiti called On That Day, Everybody Ate. It was written by someone I knew, someone who I know had gone through great sorrow, and that's part of why I found the book powerful. But what moved me even more was the story itself. The story of great poverty and deprivation in Haiti, existing side by side with great hope. It's a story about one Bay Area woman's journey to Haiti, about being changed by what she saw and bringing change in return. And it's the story of an organization she founded called the What If Foundation, a Berkeley-based nonprofit that now feeds 1,000 children 5 times a week in Haiti. The book is called On That Day, Everybody Ate, and the author is Margaret Trost. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. I want to ask you first, Margaret, about that first trip to Haiti nearly 10 years ago and a first church service that you went to and a prayer that you heard that day.
The group I was with, we went to the service and I didn't understand anything that was being shared. It was in Creole. But the church was packed and I was sitting just shoulder to shoulder, really glued to my Haitian neighbors, this congregation. And at the end of the service, I could see everybody just be excited, and the children stood on the pews, and people rose to their feet, put their arms over their head, and there was this incredible prayer, this call and response from the priest in the front and the congregation. And I didn't know what they were saying, but I just knew that they were praying with all their might. And there was a word at the end, Osaku, which was called out and just held for a long time. Osaku. And after that prayer and being so moved by how people just were crying out, I asked the person next to me what that meant, Osaku. And this older woman looked into my eyes and she just lifted her index finger and she drew in the air 3 letters, S-O-S. So I heard Osaku, and I was told, meant help.
In that first trip to Haiti, now nearly 10 years ago, help is part of what you were there to provide. And it happened in really small ways. And you talk about one of the things you did on that first visit was visiting a home for the dying and discovering a sense of what could happen when you just held someone's hand. Describe that moment when you were holding that one person's hand, if you would.
I was with a very young woman. I'm guessing she was in her 20s, and she was dying of a combination of tuberculosis and AIDS. And I sat next to her, and I couldn't really remember any of my high school French. I didn't speak Creole. But there we were, two women sitting next to each other. And she invited me to sit at the end of her cot. And I was a little bit nervous because I didn't know her, and I didn't know if I was imposing. And her eyes were closed, and she was having a hard time breathing. And I just didn't know if she wanted me there. But she opened her eyes just slightly and just nodded, just giving me permission to hold her hand. And I asked her if she'd like a massage because I had some massage cream, and she nodded yes, and she drew my hand to her chest. She wanted me to press hard there because that I found out later to have pressure there for people with tuberculosis that provided some relief. And it seemed too intimate for strangers, but she just called me in. And as she moved her nightgown over to the side, I saw the familiar lines of stretch marks and just smiled, having my own in the very same space. And so here were these two mothers that couldn't communicate through language, but were communicating as human beings, as women, as moms, holding hands. And there was great healing that I felt from her in inviting me into her world and relating to me as a woman, and that I could give the same to her and be of comfort with her because she was alone.
And you write about in that moment of holding hands that you were providing comfort, but that you were receiving as well.
That's right. Well, it reminded me of a time in my life where I had received that very similar comfort, where someone had come to me with a bottle of hand lotion and had not said any words and just massaged my hands. And it was after my husband had unexpectedly died of an asthma attack, and he was just 36 years old, and I was 34, and our little boy had just turned 5. And I was absolutely in shock, and it was in the first days afterwards where I just didn't know what to do. And a friend came over, and she didn't say anything because I didn't want to talk, but she had that hand lotion, and she massaged my hands, and it was one of the most loving, most compassionate, beautiful things that I had received from someone. And I felt in a sense that I was able to pass that on and give that love that was given to me during a very difficult time, pass that on to this woman sitting there.
Well, tell us more about that moment, because that is intimately connected to how you wound up going to Haiti. You were a young woman living in the Midwest with your husband, Rich, both in your early to mid-30s. As you said, your son was just 5 years old at the time. And as I recall, you're telling the story, you and Rich were just sitting side by side, talking about the future. And then what happened?
Well, we were talking about how we were going to start to slow down because we were very busy building our careers and just seemed to be two ships passing in the night. And we just pledged to take more time for each other, that we had some stability, we're beginning to get it in our businesses, and it was time to take a break and slow down. And 5 minutes later, he came to me and he said he couldn't breathe. And he was holding an inhaler, which he carried for occasional times where he was having some tightness and problems breathing. He had minor asthma. We'd never been to the hospital for an asthma attack before. But I thought he was kidding at first because he'd never said that before. But I could see in his eyes he wasn't. And as we rushed to the hospital, we were just told to wait for the ambulance to come to us. But by the time it arrived, he died.
So in 5 minutes, your life completely came undone. You were 34 years old with a 5-year-old child, and suddenly your husband is gone. And you went through a period of time then of wondering about what would happen next. You moved from the Midwest here to Berkeley, where a sister lived. And then this invitation to Haiti happened.
I was really open at that time and searching for something different and something new to try to bring me out of the grief that I was really stuck in. I loved being a mother to my son Luke and was running my business, but there was like a light that had been inside. It had just been snuffed out, and I wanted to be excited and live with joy and look to the future again with some spring in my step and some fire in my heart, and it just wasn't there. And so I was praying for guidance and looking for something that could help me move forward. And so when this invitation to come to go to Haiti came, it was so out of the blue. I had never thought about it. I wasn't even exactly sure where Haiti was, knowing it was in the Caribbean, but would need to search a little bit to find it. And it just felt right. I just was ready to go, and the opportunity to be of service, to reach out to others and be with them, I just knew that would bring me out of my own suffering and to move me someplace else. But the trip also involved understanding the great gifts, the great teachings that we could learn from Haitians, so much that we needed to know about their lives and so much that they could teach us about our own, and how the experience would be very powerful and transformative. And I wanted that, so I went.
Margaret Trost, our guest this hour. Her book is called On That Day, Everybody Ate, One Woman's Story of Hope and Possibility in Haiti. And so there you were in Haiti after having gone through this great tragedy, and you're beginning to make these connections with other people, even through as simple a moment as holding someone's hand. And you also met someone then, someone you refer to as Father Jerry in the book. Who is he? What happened when you met him?
Father Jerry is one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met. I didn't know who he was. He came to speak to our group about Haitian history and politics and spirituality and the fight for democracy. And so he was one of the guest speakers. And it was a night that I wasn't going to go because I was feeling overwhelmed and depressed by everything I had seen there and not knowing how to respond. But I heard this laughter coming from the balcony where we were to meet. And there was this joy in that. And it was just a sound I hadn't heard much in those first few days. And I was very drawn to it. And that was part of him. There was this ability to have a tremendous vision for change, to have great hope for the future, to believe in the power of small steps to make a difference. So this vision that he would convey not only to his congregation but to all in Haiti, the poor majority, he was their spiritual leader. And yet take that vision and then break it down into what we need to do today. And so he was a man of action. But in our conversation with this group, somebody asked him about hunger in Haiti. It wasn't something that he was really touching on. But he paused and he looked over the balcony railing, and I remember him glancing out into the dark, and he said, "I have a vision for a food program for the hungry children in my community. They come to me and they say, 'Mon père me gringou,' which means 'I'm hungry' in Creole." And he described how it broke his heart that he wasn't able to feed them. And in that moment, I was sitting there, having seen those children myself and having a child that same age and wanting to respond in some way. And so when he said he had a vision for a food program, there was like a spark or a light inside me. And I just thought, what if there was a way I could help make that vision a reality? So it was just a question that stuck in my mind. I left for Berkeley a couple days later, but I never forgot him. I never forgot that woman at the hospice. I never forgot those children that I'd seen. And it stayed with me. It didn't haunt me. It really felt like it was calling to me, his vision and what I'd experienced.
And was that spark also a time when you began to move forward out of your own grief at the loss of your husband, a sense of thinking, this is what comes next?
Well, I was thinking that. I was curious. I was searching. But I didn't know where it would lead because I didn't know how I could help. Here I was in Berkeley. It's very far from Haiti. I didn't speak Creole. I didn't really speak much French. I didn't understand the details. I hadn't studied anything about how to help somebody with a food program in another country. I mean, it just was out of anything that I had experienced, and yet my desire to help was there. And so I shared my story, what I had seen, how the people I had met had made such a difference. And really, there was some healing that took place as I was with those women in Saint-Fille at that hospice. And I was feeling like I was moving forward because I was out of my own world and starting to think about others and outside of mine. So yes, I was moving forward. But it was after I shared my story and a serendipitous, this miraculous check arrived, money that was supposed to go to a Milwaukee food pantry that sadly had closed down, that was redirected to me because it had been heard that I wanted to help with this food program. So it was that timing that to me seemed like a sign that not only did I want to respond, but I was given a way, given something that I could send down. And so then I did, and I didn't know where it would lead. I didn't know if that would be it. I didn't know it would be the beginning of basically the rest of my life and continued healing and excitement and purpose. But through that check, and then what Father Jerry did with it, in terms of within 3 weeks, that food program starting, the community celebrating, food being passed out, and he wrote me and he said, "There is great hope." You know, that's where I started to light up.
And part of what's so striking about the story, for me reading it, is that speed with which something happened. You go home to Berkeley, you're thinking about this transformative moment where you want to respond, you want to help. You have this conversation with your father, who's involved mm-hmm. in social change activities in Wisconsin, and he has this check that was supposed to go to a homeless shelter. And he says, "Well, you know what? This is to help feed the poor too. Maybe you can use it." And then all of a sudden, people are getting fed. I mean,
right.
the sort of speed and simplicity of it is pretty remarkable. Money comes in, meals get made, people eat. It happens like that.
Well, that's right. They were ready, and Father Jerry and his community, you know, had a vision for feed the children and to put them into school, and they just didn't have the resources. They were ready, and are, and people, you know, throughout Haiti and around the world, ready to go, but didn't have the resources to go to the farmer's market to buy the food that could then be cooked and served. And so within 3 weeks, boom, this was happening. And they decided that they would do this meal weekly because they wanted that money to stretch. They didn't know if there'd ever be another check. So once a week for about 500 children, this meal was served for 4 years. And then slowly, as the word spread and I continued to do all I could to raise awareness, we were able to increase to then 2 meals and then 3 and then 4 and now 5. But there was great celebration for just one meal a week, which I couldn't get my mind around at first because I felt like it just wasn't enough and what was it doing. But really that one meal was doing quite a bit. It was providing hope. It was letting that community know that they hadn't been forgotten, that there were people in solidarity with them. And it was creating community and bringing people together. It was making a difference.
You created a foundation, the What If Foundation, to begin to raise money to funnel down to Haiti. How much are you raising? What does it take to feed 1,000 children 5 times a week?
Well, it's about $5,000 a week, and 1,000 to 1,500 are fed daily. That's what it costs, and that's about $260,000 a year. There are now, we've grown. At first, it was all volunteer in Haiti, but we've been able to grow to the point where there's a 30 people that cook those meals, an incredible group of women and then also men that help in serving it and doing it with great love, great compassion, great dignity. The meals are made with food from the farmer's market, Haitian spices. It's delicious. So it's a celebration of Haitian food. And as it's given, there is song and there is clapping and there's great joy. And so this is the way they wanted to provide meals. So it's their vision of how foods could be provided. So it's about $260,000 a year. And I've also am raising money to provide school scholarships for their children. Father Jerry always said to me, he said, "Margaret, first we feed the children, we keep them alive. Then school." For, you know, the priorities, obviously education is critical. But if the child hasn't eaten, if they can't think, if they are starving, if they are sick, that needs to be addressed first. So we wanted to feed the children first, keep them alive, then school. So there's a portion of the budget that goes to pay for school scholarships and also an after-school program and a summer camp. So over the years, it's grown with the vision and the ideas of what the community wants to do. It's run by them. They know how they want to meet the needs of those among them who are suffering. And then the resources, the What If Foundation provides those. So we're in partnership, and that's why it works.
So out of this moment, following the despair and grief over losing your husband as a 34-year-old, you have this transformative moment. You come back. You start a foundation. You're, as you say, you're someone who was running a small business but had never ventured into this sort of terrain before. Now it's this ongoing program that feeds so many children. And yet, there must be times when you feel like, how much will this really bring about change? Haiti is still so impoverished. There's still such terrible unemployment. There's still such hunger. How do you weigh that? How do you weigh what you are doing versus the enormity of the problem?
Well, that's a very good question, and I wrestle with that day of all the time. I mean, the enormity is huge, and not just in Haiti, but around the world. And I come back to two things. One is, this is where I was led. I ended up in Port-au-Prince. I met Father Jerry. He expressed a vision of a food program. It touched my heart. I responded, and I feel a connection. I feel that's where my efforts are to go. Just walking here to the station, the homeless on the street right here in San Francisco, the hunger, the need, the employment right here. It's great. We don't have to look far. But for me, I was brought to Haiti. For me, my heart connected there with this community in Port-au-Prince and with this food program. And that's what they want to do, feed and then educate their children. So that's one thing. That's where I feel very directed. But Father Jerry taught me early on a very important Haitian saying, petit petit n'arrivé. And that means little by little we will arrive. And in Haiti, what they taught me is to value the small steps, to value the little. And so when I question that what I'm doing isn't enough, when I realize that it isn't changing the reasons why they're hungry, which are very complicated economic and political and historical reasons of which our country is very much a part of, it's not addressing that. I think of petit petit arrivé, and I think about that this is my direction, where I was placed, the community that I was connected with, and that this little step, this little meal, those children that are receiving scholarships will then have an education, and perhaps they will be able to contribute back to be part of that change. then I start to value the little and I stop thinking of the huge that can often immobilize us, make us think that our what we do doesn't matter, make us think that it's not good enough, it's not big enough, it's not important enough. But what I've learned and been taught by the Haitian people is it does matter. They taught me that one meal matters. They told me that one meal was a miracle. They told me in Haiti that if you eat once, you're considered rich. So to be able to provide one meal, that mattered to them. And that was helping provide nourishment and hope and solidarity. And that from that, other things could spring. So Petit Petit Narivé guides me.
Margaret Troost, on that day, everybody ate. One woman's story of hope and possibility in Haiti. Tell me about the family you stayed with, because they really became to you a family. In fact, as I recall in your book, they would say to you when you arrived, welcome home.
That's right. I went to Haiti for a summer with my son, Luke. He was 8 at the time. And I thought in living there amongst them, the connection that we felt could build, I could understand more what they wanted to create and how I might be able to be helpful here. But also, there's a part of me, Dave, that just wanted to escape and go there. I was living and still do in such a fast-paced world, struggling with balance, trying to fit it in as a mom and as a business owner and running the foundation and all these things. And there was something that just called to me from Haiti. And so I told Father Jerry that I wanted to come for the summer with Luke. And there we were. And he said, I have the perfect family for you to visit. So I drove into this place where there is a home and this beautiful woman in her late 70s came out. Mommy Dad is her name. Mother Dad. She was the mother of the community. And she did. She reached out to me and she said, welcome home, Margot. She'd already given me a nickname. She welcomed me home and she took me in like I was hers. And hand in hand, we'd walk to Mass every day. And side by side, we'd peel the carrots and slice the beans and prepare the meal for that Sunday. And through the love that she shared and through the joy that I saw that went into preparing that meal and the time that they took for it. I mean, hours and hours and hours.
And in fact, you write about how that bothered you initially because you wanted to be efficient. You were used to what you have to do to get things done in this particular zip code.
Right.
And part of what you learned was to just stop.
Stop. I know. I found that my hands were speeding up in competition to see if I could get more mangoes done in record time. Yes, we move so fast here in cell phones and emails and voicemails and how quickly you can get something done and how much, you know, how big or how fast. And there was just a whole different time that was there. There, people were together. We were in community. And so in making that meal, it was an opportunity to share stories and to support each other and to be together. And boy, we're missing that. So there were places that I was so hungry for, that to be in the moment, to appreciate what was right in front of me, to take a slower pace, to pour a lot of love into the little thing that was being done in that moment. And so I learned that from watching them. And the laughter that was part of it and the joy that was there, this old trumpet that was out of tune that was being played as the meals were being served, to recognize that right along the grief, right along the suffering, right along the pain, that there could be this joy and this hope. And so they taught me that.
Margaret Troost. Again, the book, On That Day, Everybody Ate. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're going to open up the phone lines now so that you can call in and ask your questions to Margaret about her book and about her foundation, the What If Foundation. And we're also going to talk more about what's going on in Haiti today. We'll be joined by someone who can fill us in on some of the challenges, many, many challenges that still face that country. We'll get to that discussion when we return. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson, back with more with Margaret Troost, and On That Day, Everybody Ate, in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Margaret Troost, whose story is told in a book called On That Day, Everybody Ate, a story about how she was changed by a journey to Haiti and the change in turn that she was able to help bring to that struggling country. We welcome your calls as we continue our conversation. Again, the number 866-733-6786. We'll get to our calls in just one moment. But before we do, we're also joined now by Brian Concannon, who's director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He's long been active in a variety of causes, working in particular to help with human rights conditions in Haiti and pursuing legal cases and working to bring human rights to political prisoners in particular in Haiti. Brian, thanks. Thanks for joining in our conversation this morning.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave, and it's great to hear Margaret talk about this, too.
One of the things I asked Margaret right before a break, and I'd like you to comment on as well, because you work on these sort of bigger, intractable kinds of problems, human rights, social justice, political prisoners, and Margaret was talking about the value of, you know, one small step at a time, feeding the hungry, making sure a child gets at least a meal on a day. And how, and I'm curious about how you respond to that, about whether or not that, in your judgment, also makes a difference given the size and scope of the problems that a country like Haiti faces.
I think it certainly makes a difference. I think it makes a difference to the child that gets a meal or gets an education. I think it makes a difference to us because to the extent that we say we're just going to let that happen, let this kid go to bed hungry, that really diminishes our humanity. But I also think that, you know, your question raises the issue, is that going to make a difference in the overall situation? And I think that although we do need to respond as individual humans to other individual humans, we also need to keep an eye on the bigger picture, because your question implies that there are structural injustices that create things like hundreds of thousands of kids in Haiti who don't get a meal before they sleep, and we obviously can't help all of them. And I think that Father Jerry is a great incarnation of the answer to your question, because one of the things he did, as Margaret mentioned, was he ministered to his flock. He created this great feeding program, but he was also looking at the bigger picture. He was always asking very tough questions of his government, of the international community, asking why he needed to feed his parishioners, why they couldn't feed themselves. And he ended up paying a very high price for asking those questions. He was arrested in 2004 and then in 2005. He spent a total of 8 months in jail and under very difficult conditions. He ended up having untreated leukemia. And so he paid a very high price for asking those questions. But I think it's important for the rest of us who don't take the same risks he does to ask those questions, of the Haitian government, but also to ask those questions of our government. And I think one episode that Father Jerry liked to always raise was in 1988, the U.S. and other donor countries decided that we felt Haiti's rice tariffs were too high. And so we forced the government to drop their tariffs, which had protected Haiti's rice fields. And, you know, most U.S. agriculture production is very heavily subsidized. Haiti's wasn't. So Haiti couldn't compete without those tariffs. And what happened was in 1 year, U.S. rice flooded the market and Haitian rice farmers went out of business forever. And that's one of the factors why today, 20 years later, 30 years later, the Haitian people can't feed themselves, and they do need programs like Margaret's.
Brian Kincannon, the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, joining us this hour by phone. So it's all these steps, Margaret, in a sense. It's the steps that have to be made on the policy side. It's the steps that have to be made to feed the hungry. They're not one or the other. They both need doing.
No, it's all. And for me, this is the area where I had the connection and can put my time to respond. But I completely agree with Brian. There are things that have to happen on a global scale in priorities and to shift these things so that these children aren't hungry to begin with. And there are little things that could be done. Brian has a program, 30 Minutes for Haiti, just breaking it down. If people spent 30 minutes, there's something that we could each do that could help change the policies or put pressure on or raise awareness to shift things on a much larger scale.
We'll hear about more of that, I hope, in a moment. But before we do, and before we get to all of the calls that are stacking up, I want to ask you to complete the story of Father Jerry, because Brian mentioned that he paid this price, that he was imprisoned for some time a number of years ago, was in poor health. Tell us what's happened.
Well, Father Jerry died in May, and it was just devastating, of course, for all of us who work with him, all of us who are inspired by him, and we carry on what he talked about, what he lived his life for, and his voice and his encouragement and his hope and his activism and his love carries on through all of us. So we miss him deeply, and are so sad. And also, for me, will always be inspired. I still feel him with me. I can hear him in my head. I can hear his laugh, and I can hear him encouraging me through Petit Petit Arrivé. And also, just as Brian said, calling the question as to why this is happening and asking all of us to step forward in faith and courage to do something about it.
Margaret Trost, our guest this hour, joined also this half hour with Brian Concannon, who's the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. And to our calls, let's hear next from Alex, who joins us from Margaret's old state of Wisconsin, listening, I suspect, on the Sirius XM satellite network. Alex, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. Yes, I'm listening to you on Sirius. The question that is basic to all these hungry mouths is, where did they come from? How does your guest feel about population, control and through conception control?
Alex, thanks.
Well, that's an important question, and I know from what I've read and when I've talked to some of the people in Haiti, access to birth control, access to health care, even the access to the options or even knowing about that isn't really even there. I also know from talking to people who've worked in Africa and other places that when there's such infant mortality, that more than one child is something that is just seen as part of the life there. So I think it's something that needs to be addressed. But as Brian pointed out, the other reasons, the conditions that make it difficult for people to earn a living, make it difficult for them to receive an education, make it just so difficult to just live a life with the basic needs, that is critical and I think needs to come first.
Brian, you want to chime in on that? Because this question does often come up, that part of the reasons for hunger is that there are just too many people. Do you want to respond to that, but also the other sort of structural issues that make those children needing the kind of program that Margaret has developed?
Sure. I think just to add to what Margaret said, I mean, this is obviously an incredibly complicated issue, but a couple of things that I think are important are first, that in many cases, having large families is a rational economic choice by parents out of the desperation of poverty. They know that when they're too tired to work, there's no Social Security, and their Social Security is having a bunch of kids and hoping that one gets to the United States and can then support them in their old age. It's also for women, a lot of times, even if there are technically available contraception out there, they don't, in practical terms, have the ability to make a choice because of the combination of their economic situation and the social situation with their partners. And one thing that and this is not my field, but everything I've read, the one factor that makes the biggest difference in terms of population control is the economic and social empowerment of women, and that's much more important than the mere availability of technical population control measures. And so I think that a program like Margaret's that's giving women jobs, making sure everybody has enough food to eat, that in fact is a way of changing the calculus of Haitian families when they decide whether to have more children.
Let's go to Grace next in Santa Clara. Grace, go ahead, please. Grace, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I wanted to know if you could please give us an address where we could send our check, and also let you know that yesterday I was in a parking lot and I saw all this currency on the ground, and I picked it up. There was no one around, and I wanted to give it to some charity. And so thank you for this program. You'll get it.
Wow. Well, thank you, Grace. And 70 cents is what a meal costs, so that money will turn into meals. It'll go right to those children. We're at the whatiffoundation.org is our website, and there's a way to donate through there and also our address, but 1563 Solano Avenue, number 192 in Berkeley, 94707 is our address. But whatiffoundation.org on the website is a way that you can connect with us as well.
So just What If Foundation, all one word spelled together. So whatiffoundation.org. Damien writes, I've never written in before. I'm listening to KQED, and I'm astounded to hear Margaret Trost's story. It was my story, too, in a way. I spent two separate trips, going to a church when I was a teenager. That trip, Haiti and Father Jerry, changed my life. So thank you, Margaret, for your service to this beautiful and sometimes forgotten place in our hemisphere. To Helen next in St. Helena. Go ahead, Helen. Hard to say that.
Hi.
Helen, St. Helena. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Margaret. I wanted to say that I was so pleased to hear you on the radio. We were driving, and there you are. And it's very appropriate because I'm just about to put a check in the mail to the What If Foundation for the proceeds of our farm stand, which we just closed down last weekend.
Thank you, Helen. Helen grows vegetables on her land in a small garden and has used that farm stand and directed the proceeds to come to What If. And that's something that I love about What If. That really the What If Foundation represents people across the country, their hearts, their compassion, and what they can do to then share their resources, whether it's selling the produce or finding the money as Grace did or whatever it is, that collectively this money comes together and then we get it directly to the people in St. Clair's who go to the farmers market, so it helps support the Haitian economy, provides jobs, and then feeds the children.
Paul in Northfield, Minnesota has our next question. Paul, go ahead.
Yes, I want to greet Margaret and Brian both. Say hello, both good friends of mine. And Margaret is coming to see us in 2 weeks with a lot of events planned. And Brian has done that in the past. So hello to my good friends. And my question is, how is the community of St. Clair's adjusting to the loss, and Haiti as well, the loss of Father Jean Juste and his tremendous courage that he showed during all the political upheaval and his own challenges, where Haiti is at with that and the community as well, but sort of just an overview of what his loss, how people are dealing with that loss.
Paul, thank you. Margaret, why don't you respond first, and then Brian, I'd like you to chime in as well about sort of the state of political prisoners and human rights issues in Haiti right now. But Margaret?
For the St. Clair's community, it's a profound loss, as you can imagine, Paul. But Father Jerry just instilled such hope and such a vision for the future that everybody there continues to work on it. So it's not just throwing hands up and thinking without him we can't do it. He has really worked with the people, created teams and a community there where they are working together to carry on his legacy and working together to work with the What If Foundation so that the vision that he had for a school and other things for the community can come to form. So in that sense, I feel like they're doing very well in taking the steps to continue on, even though there is obviously great grief.
And Brian, in terms of how the issues of human rights and political prisoners in particular are continuing to play out in Haiti, the last few years seems like there's been greater stability since René Préval became a president. But we read that just last night, in fact, that the Senate there threw out the prime minister. And so it seems like we may be in for another period, perhaps, of upheaval. What's your sense of what's going on right now in terms of that sort of political instability and the prospects for continued human rights concerns?
Well, I think it's important to make a pretty strong distinction between what was happening in 2004 and 2005 when Father Jerry was getting arrested and what's happening now. I think during that time there was a government under a guy named Gerard Latortue who was actually flown from Florida by the United States to be put in the prime minister's job in Haiti. And that was a dictatorship. And Haiti had the human rights problems of a dictatorship, including massive political prisoners, massive killing of political dissidents. Now, since 2006, Haiti's had a democracy, and it still has human rights problems. And I would say it's the human rights problems of a democracy rather than the dictatorship. There are still some political prisoners left from the previous dictatorship, but the current government is not arresting its political opponents. But I think that also that is, and every day we need to be grateful that transition has in fact happened. But there are some human rights problems of democracies that Haiti is suffering from that do not bode well. And I don't think necessarily the firing of the ousting of the prime minister is itself a problem. It's a very complicated decision as to whether she was as unsuccessful as the Senate had said she was. But I think what's a really more important issue is who's making that call. And the Constitution gives the Senate the right to give this vote of no confidence, which they did. And that's certainly within their rights to do. But an underlying problem is almost all of those senators, well, all of those senators were actually elected under under disputed circumstances. Two-thirds of them were elected back in 2006 under the dictatorship, who ran a flawed election. And in fact, the political party, that was one of the reasons why Father Jerry was arrested, was to keep him from being a presidential candidate in those elections. And there are lots of other people who were either arrested or exiled to keep them from running in those elections. Then the other third of the Senate was elected early this year. And what the government did was they excluded the one party that everybody knew was going to win most of the seats. They came up with a pretext for removing that party, which really was not justified by either the law or the practice. And so you end up having a parliament of basically second-place candidates. And a third problem is there was supposed to be another election now, this month, in November and December, and they're just not having it. So in the sense, the Senate, two-thirds of the Senate should be going before the people this month or next month as a referendum on this, but that's not going to happen. So they're basically getting a pass on this, on getting rid of the prime minister. The people won't have the opportunity to weigh in on it.
You know, I want to offer a connection point to something else that's very much in the news right here, and not that they're analogous situations, but right now we're struggling so with what to do in Afghanistan, in a country that's not stable, obviously, at all. And again, not to make a parallel between the two, Haiti appears in many ways to be much further along. But this question comes up when a country is not stable, when we don't know what the future is going to be, when problems seem to be so daunting. We seem to have a sense right now in this country of wanting to sort of pull back from those things. How do you look at that, Margaret, when you look at sort of how huge the problems are in Haiti, questions about whether or not the democracy, how well it will function? Do you still see the importance of taking those small steps no matter what?
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. The children are hungry. They're not going to school. And with the work that Brian's doing and others, there are people in prison that haven't seen a judge in years. There's health care available. And it needs to be done with respect. It needs to be done in cooperation and partnership with the people. It has to be done with keeping the poor majority in mind. So often there's been help from the outside or help, perhaps even USAID or something like that, but it's benefited U.S. corporations or supposed help from our government that has not been beneficial for the people. So a lot of times the help that's been coming has actually hurt the people. So when we can work in solidarity with them, when there is with compassion and love and understanding of these larger issues, the historical and political parts of this puzzle, with that sensitivity and working alongside, then change can come. And we come out just thinking we know better and come in and impose our way, that's never helpful.
I suppose there's also a pragmatic sort of foreign policy reason for this too, if you want to think about it that way. In other words, for example, after the tsunami, the image of the United States, as I understand it, went up quite a lot in those affected countries because we were there to help and we were providing something very basic like meals for people who are hungry. So there's that part of this too, just as it makes a difference in a very concrete way for the children in Haiti that the What If Foundation is helping. It also serves as a reminder for the kinds of policy help that this country can provide. Gregory in Santa Rosa has our next observation. Gregory, go ahead.
I'd like to raise the issue of what's the factor that's needed to make this fundamental change. It seems to me that having democracy and economic change economic change is dependent upon having a democracy, and having a functioning democracy is dependent on U.S. support for that. And that every time the Haitians try to develop democracy, it tends toward a socialist, democratic socialism, and the U.S. intervenes and installs the dictator. So to me, the U.S. is the primary reason the Haitians are not allowed to develop their own democracy.
Gregory, thank you.
What do your guests think about that?
Yeah, Gregory, thank you. Brian, why don't you respond? Sound like you also wanted to get a response on the last point, too. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I can actually you combine those. I think Gregory's right in that the U.S. has ill-served Haiti. And in terms of what we should do, we actually know what we should do because we did it between 1995 and 2000 and about 2000, where we were investing in democracy and we were supporting the people that the Haitian electorate voted into office. And the problem is when we decide we don't like what those people do, then we start intervening. And that's never going to create a stable Haiti. And what we need to do is we need to accept the fact that the Haitian people might elect people that we wouldn't. And if we really believe in democracy, we need to support that. And kind of following on in your question about Afghanistan and Haiti, there are obviously some parallels, as you mentioned, but one of the important things is that there are also some very large differences. Haiti does not have any entrenched ethnic battles. They don't have a history of armed resistance. They don't have a lot of the problems that Afghanistan has. And one of the shames about Haiti being in such tough shape is that it is so easy to fix. Earlier this year, I did a calculation, and Haiti's entire budget for the year for their government was a week spending on Iraq. It was 3 days spending on Iraq, or it was 2 weeks interest on our bank bailout. So this is really just, I mean, all we need to do is take a drop out of our bucket and send it to Haiti, and we can make drastic improvements in the lifestyles. But what we need to do is accept that the Haitian people might elect people we wouldn't.
Brian Concannon, director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. I guess what I'm trying to get back to, Margaret, in terms of your particular work and the way in which it's called to you, is the importance of remembering the ways in which you can make a difference. And what you were saying in our first half hour about not being overwhelmed by the hugeness or the seemingly intractableness of a particular problem, and that, in fact, when things seem that big and daunting, that perhaps it's all the more important to take those small steps, because otherwise we're just going to sort of throw up our hands at the state of the world and not do anything.
Well, that's right. And there are a number of different organizations that are working in Haiti, and the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti is one of them with Brian that gives the small steps that you can do. So I think each one of us has a place where we'll feel that connection or where we'll respond, where we'll want to. And that little step, whether it's an email, whether it's a phone call, whether it's a letter to Congress, whether it's a donation, whether it's related to Haiti or related to San Francisco or Berkeley or Oakland, it doesn't matter. It's about taking action, though. The only way we're going to make a change, the only way we can to change the way things are right at home or far away is to lift our voices, to let people know it's not okay. It's not okay for children to be starving. It's not okay for there to be homeless people on the street as I'm walking here. It's not okay. And I just kind of a regular person who didn't study all of this, but all of us would know it's not all right. And if we wait for the politicians to figure out or come to agreements, if we wait for some global economic policy that'll finally make it right, we want that to happen. And I think we need to work on the small steps that can help bring about that change through our voice and through votes, through our voices. But meanwhile, the children are hungry. Meanwhile, they're not going to school. And so that's where those little things that we can do to help create a life where they can still eat and they can thrive and they can live and they can have hope and then they can contribute to the world to work on that while these other bigger issues are happening. That's where all of us are important, whether it's right here or whether it's far away. But it really deserves a response in whatever way we feel we can do it.
You're not going back, are you? You can't ever go back to where you were in life. This has changed, transformed you. It's your life's work.
It is. It is. And that's where I just feel such gratitude for Father Jerry, for Mom Odette, and for Nen, for this community, for welcoming me and saying, thank you, Margaret, for being here and for being in solidarity that they brought me into their family. My heart is connected to them forever and those children there. So I've found kind of a home for my heart and an opportunity to respond in a way that is alongside a Haitian community. And so that's just what's the fit for me. And there are all these other issues that are important as well. And I think it's important to know about them and to raise awareness and take action there as well.
And Brian, briefly from you as well, before we begin to wrap up our program, Margaret mentioned earlier, there's something you're offering that in 30 minutes you can do. Briefly describe.
Yeah, it's called the half-hour for Haiti program, and we now put up, it's about once a month, we put out an action alert to people on our list that is an informative and concrete way that people can advance human rights in Haiti. Sometimes it's contacting U.S. elected representatives, sometimes it's contacting a Haitian government or the U.N. or the World Bank, but it's something that can be done usually in less than 5 minutes, and that makes a difference for on the ground for people in Haiti. And if people are interested in signing up for that, our website is www.haitijustice.org.
Brian Kincannon, the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Brian, thanks for being with us this past hour. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you. Margaret, I want to come back and have you repeat, if you would please, that saying that Father Jerry once said to you about how you approach things when problems seem so big. Tell us that saying again and what you think it can mean for all of us.
Petit, petit, n'arrivé. Little by little, we will arrive. And I think right now in our world and our country, with the economy we have, with the wars that are going on, with the places that it's, where it just feels hopeless, where we can be overwhelmed by our own lives, that we just have to remember what Father Jerry said and what the people in Haiti have shown us in their struggles for life day after day, that those small steps, to take small steps, matter, and to take them together in solidarity. That little steps will bring us someplace. Little steps, I think, taken in love, in compassion, in hope, in faith. Steps in that spirit are what can change the world. And we might go backwards sometimes. We might not think we're going to ever make it. But I know that taking action is critical, and small is powerful.
Margaret Trost. The book is called On That Day, Everybody Ate, One Woman's Story of Hope and Possibility in Haiti. And again, her organization is called the What If Foundation. You can find it on the web at whatiffoundation.org. Whatiffoundation.org. Margaret, great pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Tina Lorberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.